Everyone has a story to tell. What's yours? Welcome to the Around the World podcast. I'm your host, Dan Perry. Do you enjoy hearing tales of world adventure? Would you like travel advice from those who know the road well? Maybe you want to embark on a journey of your own, and you just need a bit of motivation to get started. You'll find all of that and more in the Around the World podcast. For this episode of the podcast, I sat down to talk with Josh Clemens of Reverbal Communications. Josh and I have been friends for a few years, and we snuck in a couple of hours to catch up over my short winter break in Madison, Wisconsin. I happened to be completely jet-lagged when we talked, so I didn't quite have a firm grip on reality yet. But I think that actually made things a bit more interesting as we drifted into many unexpected directions. Josh is an expert on a number of things, notably social media, as part of his job is to help people increase their presence online. He has spent a lot of time living in Israel and studying the Middle East, so he's also an expert on that part of the world. And finally, Josh happens to be the editor of my book, 1,000 Days Between. Josh is a great conversationalist, which I think will become apparent right away. So let's get right to our talk. Today, I'm sitting here with my friend Josh Clemens. We've known each other for a few years now, is that right?
Yeah.
Cool. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. It's been kind of a whirlwind trip so far in my return. Yeah, I've just kind of been going full steam for actually even in China for the last couple of months, just almost constantly traveling and doing like what I don't like to do that much. It was like traveling really fast, but I only have a couple of weeks at a time to do things. And as I go in China, I just find so many more things. I guess this no matter where you are, always happens. But we're sitting here with Josh in his home, and I don't know. I mean, we've been friends for a couple of years now, and you've done a lot of traveling, right? Yourself?
I've done a good bit of traveling. Yeah, not as much as you, but quite a bit.
Yeah. Well,
few have done as much as you.
Well, I try to get around.
You try, for sure.
Yeah. Well, let's just jump right into it.
Sure.
So, where have you all been?
I spent a little bit of time in Latin America and a little bit of time in Europe, but most of my time abroad has been in the Middle East. I lived in Israel, several different locations, and I've spent a lot of time in Egypt, Jordan, and Turkey. I spent a few summers in the region and a couple other random trips, and then I spent a year there from 2006 to 2007. That was kind of my longest trip, but I'd also been before and after for a few months here, a few months there.
Wow, and so that longest trip was just in Turkey or in the Middle East?
No, I was living in Israel. I lived in a very small town in the south of Israel called Arad. It's a planned city from the 60s of about 30,000 people. If you walk more than a mile in any direction, you're in the heart of the Negev Desert. It's literally surrounded on all sides by desert. I lived there for a while, and I lived on a kibbutz, and I volunteered for a few months on a kibbutz, and then I traveled pretty extensively throughout Israel, but also throughout Egypt, Jordan, Turkey, and tried to see as much as I could. The summer, I went a few summers later in 2009, and I did a quote, Israel-Palestine study abroad. I worked with a really amazing professor out of George Mason. We did a 10-day seminar where we traveled all over, met with everybody, really unbelievable. And then we each split up around the country and did six-week internships.
What was the goal here?
It was a grad class. I was in grad school getting a master's degree in international peace and conflict resolution. And I was learning about the region from a different perspective, and it was pretty amazing.
Oh, you're like talking to local people then?
That first 10-day seminar really was amazing. We met with journalists, we met with NGO leaders, we met with politicians, we met with soldiers, settlers, anti-settling Israelis, Palestinians affected by settlers. Like literally one day we would meet with settlers, and they would get an opportunity to explain their situation. The next day we'd meet with Palestinians affected by that situation, and the next day after that we'd meet with Israelis who were fighting against that situation, trying to end the settlements in Israel. It was like a fascinating way to get to see an issue from like truly like numerous angles. Back to back, it was pretty amazing.
Wow, sounds cool. Were these people, did they generally have a lot of hatred to each other? I mean, and you're kind of in the middle of it?
At no point in that context, I've been in other contexts, at no point in that context were we like between two groups. It was always going as students looking to learn. So we were always getting kind of the nice version of them telling us their story and trying to like sway the opinion, as we all do when we
kind of sugarcoating what's going on,
trying to explain, like, you know, we went to a settlement called Modin, and the, you know, a very, very nice couple sat down with us and explained to us why they were there and why they lived there and why they were fighting to stay there. And then we met with a Palestinian family the next day that was pretty, pretty upset by the fact that they were there. And then we met with Israelis, a group called Yesh Din, which literally means there will be justice, or there is justice, who uses the Israeli court system to fight against settlements, you know? So like really like many different angles from it. Pretty fascinating stuff for sure.
Wow. It's, let's see.
So, okay.
I should point out to the audience, I'm really jet lagged right now. I would do this interview later, but Josh is flying out tomorrow.
I'm on Central Standard Time, and Dan is on Beijing Standard Time.
Yeah.
So we're having this in the same room, but 12 hours apart.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's something like 3 or 4 in the morning in Beijing, and my body wants to go to sleep. Traveling around the world sucks. It's like the first few days are really rough for me. I'm waking up at like 3 in the morning and just...
Jet lag is a very modern invention. There was no jet lag for most of human existence.
Right, yeah.
Because you couldn't travel faster than time, and now suddenly you can.
Yeah. And it used to be so slow, and I guess I'm not complaining that much. I shouldn't complain that much. I did just like hop on a plane and
you seem pretty happy.
One country and come to another. Yeah. Like, you couldn't really do that before.
Yeah, exactly. It's pretty amazing.
It's like a lifetime journey.
A lifetime journey. And usually a one-way trip.
Yeah.
Often.
One
way. Crossing the ocean.
You didn't necessarily
know what's happening in both directions.
Didn't know what you're getting yourself into.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, there's crazy stuff, like, wars, like, ended. There's stories about this, like, a war ends, like, in Europe, and, like, they don't get word in the U.S. for, like, 3 months. So they think they're still at war. I mean, or vice versa.
Sure, it's crazy. Tell me about the time zones of China, or a singular time zone of China.
How does that work? Well, as my girlfriend likes to put it, or did put it to me once, China doesn't have any time zones. And I said, I think they have one.
A singular time zone.
Yeah, yeah. Right. No, they just have one time zone for the whole country, and it's
about the same width as the continental United States.
Yeah, you could almost map one on top of the other. They're just about the same size. Depending on what you count, usually the United States is listed as slightly bigger.
Sure.
So it'd be the third biggest country in the world, and then China would be fourth, but sometimes it's vice versa. But yeah, obviously the U.S., the continental U.S. has 4 time zones, and China only has one. They think everything is according to Beijing time, which is where the government is. And I guess that works out okay for the majority of Chinese, because most people live actually rather close to that time zone. Out of the 1.5 billion Chinese, I don't know the exact numbers, maybe 80 to 90% live fairly close to the coast.
Right.
So it'd be like almost everyone in the United States living close to DC,
right.
or
the East Coast,
or along that same longitude line. Yeah, but the people out west kind of have it rough, and the sun won't come up till like 10 in the morning, 11 in the morning, and they actually, I've heard at least that they've kind of had to invent their own time there, and they use that instead. But then that kind of gets confusing too, because they want
So they're on and off like real time.
Yeah, and they never. No one ever knows what time it is then, because it's got two different numbers to use.
Have you made it to the West Coast yet, or not yet?
No. Well, there's no West Coast, I guess, but West Side. Yeah.
Well, I'm thinking continental U.S. though.
Yeah.
To the West Side.
Right. No. No, actually, I took a train from
around Gansu province, and
which is
kind of like central China.
Okay.
And it's a really long, narrow province, but the main city is called Lanzhou, and that's kind of almost right in the middle of China. And I took a train from there to Beijing, not a bullet train, just a regular train. That took like 26 hours.
Whoa.
And that gets you to the middle of the country without crossing any major mountain ranges.
Did you go for the soft bed or stuck with the hard bed for that one?
Nah, just hard bed.
Hard bed.
Yeah, you know, so yeah.
The eternal traveler right
there. The train, yeah, yeah. The hard bed's kind of a lot of money, versus hard bed. And the main advantage is you've only got two beds stacked on top of each other rather than three. So you've got more privacy too. You've got a door that you can close, whereas hard bed is just all wide open, and you're just
You went for the hard bed.
Yeah, yeah. I guess if you're American, you might think people are like literally just stacked on top of each other, but it's culturally very normal there. It's acceptable.
Do your readers know how tall you are? Listeners know how tall you are?
Yeah, I'm like 6'3", like 1.9 meters.
Are you a giant? Is it like something out of Lost in Translation, or Chinese people are...
I go through that a lot. Chairs? Actually, I was just thinking of a line from their...
From Lost in Translation.
Yeah, where they're like, I wish I could sleep.
I mean, are you a foot above everyone, or it's not
like... No, that's what I thought before I went there. But I guess when you go to like the smaller...
I mean, you're tall for America, but
yeah,
for China, you're about the same.
I'm still tall, but I'm not giant in the cities. And I've just found when I go further away from big cities, the people get shorter and shorter. And a lot of the old farmers, I mean, they grew up like malnourished.
Wow.
You gotta remember like how many people starved
for sure
in the 50s. From malnourishment or died from malnourishment, and they didn't reach their full height's potential. And
they say that about North Korea. North Koreans are 6 inches shorter on average than South Koreans.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Same people, same family, same bloodline, but just less food.
Yeah.
Malnourished and famine, and
that'll do it.
6 inches off their average height.
That'll do it.
It's two generations.
Yeah, so I guess it's a good question of which, like, are Chinese people shorter because of genetically that just they are shorter, or is it because of the food? But actually, I think it's not really the genetics. And there's some scientists would have to chime in and answer this, but I
don't know the science there.
Just from my walking around, there are tall people in Beijing.
Yeah,
and yeah, there are people taller than me.
Cool.
I haven't seen like a Yao Ming type tall.
I was going to say one very tall.
I haven't seen anyone like that.
Yeah,
but. Now I see people my height and stuff, and it's kind of strange. Like people still, one of the first words I learned in Chinese is "gao," and it's like that means tall.
Oh, nice.
So people say "ni hao gao," like you're so tall. Like, but a lot of the time they're almost the same height as me, I'm standing right next to a Chinese person who's like the same height. So I think I just look tall.
What about the hair? Do you see men with long hair there?
Nah. You see like a few artists here and there with long hair.
Like you?
Yeah. I get asked a lot.
So it's not completely it's not something you would never see. It's just not
good. It's not unknown, but it's pretty rare. Even in cities, they tend to be more conservative, and like dress wise and that kind of thing than we are. I mean, actually, the women a lot of the time will like when they go swimming, they'll even wear like masks over their faces. They call them. I was going to say mankini from Borat. No, that's definitely not it. Facekini. They call it facekini.
They do it for modesty purposes?
I guess that's a different subject. More for like...
For health.
For to not have sun hit their skin.
Right.
And people will carry umbrellas or parasols all the time.
Yeah, sure. That's got some ancient roots to it.
Yeah,
right there.
They don't want to get dark.
Have seen, just real quick, in Alexandria and in many other places actually, but women in full burqas going in the water. Full head covered, and not just hair, but face, and full clothed going in the water. So in Israel, not all, but there are beaches that are separate, men and women. So there are Orthodox beaches, like especially at the Dead Sea. I don't know of places at the Med, but I'm sure there are. But definitely the Dead Sea has male-only and female-only beaches, because the Orthodox would not, like, go in the water at the same time. But that's the thing in hotels, too. They'll, like, shut down a pool just to men, just to women. And there's relative, like, parity to it, I think. It's not like men get 12 hours a day and women get two or anything, but it's definitely, there are some places where they will actually close down the pools or the water to a certain gender, or just split the beach in half. And
yeah, I guess a beach you could split in half. I guess a pool you could too, but no, you'd have to like put up a curtain or something.
Yeah, it defeats the purpose.
Yeah, yeah.
So
and you probably only have one pool. Maybe if you've got a hot tub, you'd have two hot tubs.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's not anywhere near on that level.
They're doing it for very different reasons.
Yeah. And people wear masks a lot, too, but that's obviously not for the religion. That's for...
Yeah. How many people out of 100 are wearing face masks?
Not many, actually. Maybe, oh, really? Maybe one. Well, it depends on what day. If it's clear weather, it's a couple here and there. But once it gets really polluted, you see more, but a lot fewer than I would have thought. That was a surprise, too. I guess because, like, you see stock photos from China, like, bad pollution photos, and they've always got people wearing masks, right? They're all wearing masks in those photos, but that's just all we're seeing.
Sure. And
if you just walk around on a normal day, or on a polluted day...
It's like 1 or 2%.
Yeah, it's not very many.
Interesting. I wouldn't have guessed 50, but I would have thought a handful, so...
Yeah.
Sounds like just a little less.
Yeah, and a lot of people wear them, actually, for their own, or to not spread disease, too. For against colds, I just see people wearing surgical masks versus the heavier masks that actually seal off your face from the outside world, where those filter out the really small particles. But the surgeon's masks, those I think are good enough to stop like viruses, like the flu. But the particles that are really nasty in the air are much smaller than that. Those will just pass right through the mask. So it also takes an educated population, and they're not quite there yet. And I don't know, a lot of it's probably indifference. They accept that this is life.
Sure.
And a lot of them haven't ever left China. They don't know what it's like to see a blue sky every day.
Right.
I will say, though, living there, I can really appreciate a blue sky now. It's like, when it's nice, I'm outside, I'm like, all day, I'm hiking, and just loving it.
You're close to the mountains, or where are you hiking?
Yeah, there's mountains near Beijing. I
kind of get that.
A lot of the time, I'm just walking through the city.
Gotcha.
I shouldn't even say hiking.
No, that's cool. But how do you get to the mountains, though, if you go?
You can take buses.
Nice. Into the mountains, or like to the base, or what?
Both. Usually they'll have buses going all the way up.
Do people live there? Is it like hills, or it's mountains?
Well, it's not like the Himalayas. You'd probably call them big hills. They're not like snow-capped or anything.
So like there's houses on them?
Yeah, there's villages.
But then there's still hiking paths and stuff as well?
Here and there.
Not so much.
There's a lot of them are paved. A lot of them are, like, they're just different than what we're used to.
Yeah. Depends on where you go.
Yeah. If you get away further, you can find, like, nicer, like, areas that are more secluded, I guess, and not don't have as many people.
Sure.
But obviously the Great Wall is really close.
Oh, it is close to you?
Yeah, it's only, the closest section is maybe only an hour, hour and a half
outside
the city. Yeah, by bus.
Have you been several times, or?
Yeah, I've been to, like, I've been there, like, 4 times to, like, 3 different sections.
Pretty amazing.
And, yeah, it's awesome. And you've got a wide variety of stuff, like, of types of the Great Wall. Like,
it's not one Great Wall.
It's not just one continuous Great Wall anymore.
Okay.
I mean, it probably never was.
Sure.
But now they've got some parts that they've restored, like, really well, and they look cool, but you kind of have to keep in mind that it's all fake.
Reconstructed.
Yeah, all reconstructed.
Right. There's a really amazing fortress in Israel. It's called Masada.
Yeah.
It's built in the heart of the desert. Like, you know, standing on Masada, it's on a mountaintop, and there's nothing else around. You can see the Dead Sea, and you can see desert, and that's it. But it was literally built on a mountaintop by King Herod, and he had built a whole, like, system so that if he ever needed to flee, he had a place to go to get to, like, he could essentially escape invading armies as needed. It was lost for a long time, and actually some archaeologists went to, like, they, like, had a map, like, from text, like, where they thought it should be. Long story short, they found it, and it's this, like, it's a pretty interesting story, and it's a large story because it's, like, part of the history of the modern state of Israel, because there was, like, a last stand at Masada that's kind of controversial. But most importantly, it's where there was, regardless of the the direction you take. There was a last stand there against the Romans. The Romans actually could not take the mountain, and they wound up having to extend the mountain in order to take it. There's actually an entire piece of the mountain that was added by the Romans. So you can actually walk up the Snake Trail, which is a very long winding trail to get up to the top, or you can take the Roman path, which is actually just a staircase that they like built. And then there's also a cable car. But the reason I brought it up is that big chunks of it were destroyed just thousands of years, and they've rebuilt parts of it, but they did a really good job of like putting lines where the original is versus where the new is. So you actually can't tell, like, it'd be like looking at a wall and it looking exactly the same, but there'd be a line like this and, where it's literally showing like the jagged lines where it ended originally and then was recreated. Huh. So it's kind of cool. You can see like what it would have looked like and also what it looks like modern on its own.
What, so the parts that are original, are they still look good?
Oh, like, yeah.
You can't even tell the difference.
It's a pretty unbelievable
that's awesome.
Piece of engineering. It actually, so it's in the middle of the desert, and so it was self-sustainable. So they were able to grow food on it, and most importantly, the mountain was built with these aquifers that actually collected water from the entire mountain, would all drain, and it had this filtration system so that it would actually, it was able to collect the, anytime there was like water, like rainwater in the desert, Masada was actually able to collect it, and it was self-sustainable, like in the desert, which is a hard thing to be. That's why the last stand was able to last as long as it did, was because they had food and water. And they ultimately fell because the Romans extended the mountain to get to the top of it, but they like could not get up the one entrance that like existed. The Jews, the last stand of Jews, were able to stop that. And then in the end, when they got to the top, the Jews had all killed themselves, the ones that were left. It's more controversial in the sense that whether these were the group of people at the top have a lot of, there's a lot of baggage around them that gets painted in different ways. They were either patriots or zealots or whatnot. Right, exactly. Which is why I say it's controversial, but it's actually a very important story for the foundation. Like, the modern state of Israel essentially was an ancient people looking for a modern story. And did some pretty amazing things with that. And part of that was Masada, this ability to, like, stand to the last second and, like, you know, defend with your life the state. So it became a pretty big part of, it became very much a part of, like, the way that we talk about our forefathers. Masada is, like, even though it was ancient, it was a very modern part of the, like, modern state of Israel. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it sounds like an interesting story. I mean, it's,
yeah.
I always love those stories of small, like, a few people holding off a giant army.
Yeah.
It's good. It's fun to cheer for that.
Right. Yeah, when they finally got there, they had all killed themselves. So.
Well, that's not so
far. Right, exactly. But, you know, they lasted for a while against the Romans, which nobody, yeah. You know, at that time was lasting right. Against the Romans. So
till those bloody Germans came in and
right.
Knocked them up.
Right.
What year was the standoff? Do you know? Or, like, exactly the year? Or approximately?
I don't know exactly what year, but it was in, like, the early zeros. Like, 2,000 years ago, give or take. Yeah. I don't know the exact year.
That'd be funny to go, like, what year were you born? Zero.
For sure. Even Jesus wasn't born at zero.
Yeah, I guess there wasn't one, right?
Yeah, I don't think they talked about it like that back then. That came shortly after.
Well, when when someone asks, like, how old a baby is, I like to say zero.
Oh, like before they're 1 year old?
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, they're zero.
I'm gonna round down here.
Yeah. Just to be funny.
For sure.
Yeah, so sounds like you know a lot about Israel and the Middle East, and you've been there a lot. I guess one thing I'm wondering is, in the news, we've always got, like, terrorism and ISIS and all these bad things. Let's just focus on Israel for now, because I know a lot of people are interested in going there, but maybe a little hesitant. Like, what's it like to travel there nowadays? Do you have a pretty good idea?
So,
or what's the current kind of sure. situation, I mean, politically?
So, essentially, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is complicated, and it is an everyday part of life for some, and it's not at all a part of life for many. Very similar to Americans. Crime issue, you know, our gang issue doesn't, like, it's a very big problem for a lot of people, but most Americans are not affected by that kind of crime. They live in a world that doesn't exist, and that's true in Israel as well. The most recent spate of conflict, however, has been very, like, interesting is a word that implies some positive connotation, which I'm obviously not implying, But essentially, you know, the first intifada was stones and rocks and protests. The second intifada was bombs. And the third intifada, nobody's calling it an intifada yet, but it certainly has the makings. An intifada...
What does that mean?
Intifada, the first... So the second intifada happened in the early 2000s, and it was when Palestinians were blowing themselves up on buses and in restaurants. Like, that was the second intifada. It literally means the shaking off. No, sorry, that's jihad. The intifada was essentially, they were... It was a battle waged against Israel, if you will, by Palestinians trying to change the status quo. I won't parse it more than that.
Yeah, you don't have to like get into it.
Right.
Like,
but so right now, it's not an intifada right now, but there is definitely, I get alerts from Haaretz on a daily and often 5 to 6 times a day that there was a stabbing, somebody rammed somebody with a car, somebody attacks somebody with a screwdriver, and
is this like a Twitter feed or something? Or
I get just alerts on my phone from the New York Times, from Politico, from
Haaretz. I thought you said a specific word.
Oh, Haaretz. Sorry, Haaretz is a major newspaper out of Israel. If you're looking to follow what's going on in Israel, it's a great.
Oh, so if you're thinking about going there, that'd be maybe a good spot to.
Haaretz is just a newspaper, but it's a great paper. Definitely recommend checking it out.
Okay.
They are great on Twitter, and they. You know, I mean, it's a very old paper.
Obviously, it must be in English.
They have a Hebrew and an English version.
Oh,
okay. Haaretz literally means the land. And it's a, you know, it's been around since pretty much the beginning of the state. And I get news alerts from them that are, I get them, like I said, from several people. Haaretz is a good one for me to follow what's going on in Israel, whereas Politico is good for politics and the New York Times is good for general things. And, you know, mm-hmm. Every alert has its purpose.
I
try to use them to get all the stories I'm looking to get. But, you know, I'll wake up sometimes and see that, like, there were 6 conflagrations in the last 12 hours in Israel. You know, like, since I checked my phone last, like, 3 people were stabbed and 1 person was shot and there was a car ramming. And it's this very different kind of conflict that's going on right now that it's becoming, tragically, it's becoming almost, like, personal. Not to imply that it had not been personal, but it's literally, you know, a bomb. You can close your eyes and hit a button, and that's that. A knife, you have to walk up to a person and, like, be within, like, a foot of that person or inches of that person. So it's, I think, it's hard for me to say what the current state is now. I have friends there, and they're certainly not happy with what's going on, obviously. I think it's a scary time right now in Israel, but it's also, you know, I have been there when there's been attacks, and if nobody had told me that it had happened, you wouldn't know. Like, for as small as a country it is, it's not like, you know, it's still a country, and it's still a country that's, you know, a terrorist attack in Jerusalem does not mean that Tel Aviv shuts down. It just doesn't. They've been through so many attacks, and there's been so much conflagration there that you could be on a beach in Tel Aviv and have no idea that there's conflict raging in the south, you know, between, like, the Gaza, like, on the Gaza border, or in the north with Lebanon, or, you know, in general, anywhere else.
Interesting, such a small country, though.
For such a small country, but it's still a big, vibrant country with enough going on, and, like, you know, it's a very interesting culture there, because they have a draft, so, and they have a reserve. Most Israelis, not all by any stretch, but most Israelis serve in the military and then stay in the reserves for about until they're in their 40s. So there's a, like, in and out of military service within Israel. So people are, like, tapped in that way. And if, like, when Israel goes to war, quote unquote, with Lebanon, like, the reservists get called up. But I have been in Israel for sure when there have been terrorist attacks. And again, if somebody didn't tell you, you wouldn't know. It doesn't feel different in Tel Aviv when somebody blows up a cafe in Eilat, per se.
Yeah.
And that being said, I was not there during the second intifada when things were, when there was a lot of bombings, and I'm sure the country felt very different then. I can only speak about my own experience, obviously.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I was just thinking about that coming back to the U.S., because if I look up the U.S. news, like, go to some website centered in the U.S., all you hear about is murders and stabbings, whatever, shootings, mass shootings. It's almost constant. And from the outside, if I weren't from here, I would just think that this country's just gone crazy.
You're talking about America?
Yeah.
I was going to say, I think if if you've never been to America, this sounds like a scary place to come right now.
It does.
Most Americans know is not the case.
It's terrifying. But then, yeah, you come here and it's like, oh, yeah, right. Even me, being from here.
Right.
Like, I just hadn't been here for a year and a half.
Right.
But even I would go, wow, because, I mean, China's a different animal, of course.
For sure.
But, you know, the crime rate in Beijing, at least petty crime, like muggings.
Fire low.
Very low.
Very low.
Very low. You almost never...
For petty crime, what about violent crime?
No, almost not. You almost never hear about...
Really?
Maybe pickpocketing, there's some...
Is it that it's not happening or that you're not hearing about it?
No, I think you would hear about it. I mean, there was this guy that, like, it was really weird. This guy from southern China showed up at this shopping mall last fall, and... Yeah, and he stabbed a guy, a French guy, and his new wife, his Chinese wife, and killed the woman, and it severely injured the guy. And, yeah,
was it motivated by something specific, or he was just crazy?
I think he was crazy. I don't know the whole story, but...
Obviously, he was crazy.
The dude was walking around with a samurai sword, a 3-foot samurai sword.
Oh, my God.
And he just stabbed these two, and he was just kind of still pacing back and forth while these two were lying on the ground bleeding to death. And
this was at a mall?
Yeah, outside of a very modern shopping mall. But that's, like, the one thing.
It's rare. Could,
yeah. Oh,
that's
yeah,
not happening on every couple of days.
No. That was a really isolated incident.
I mean, so, I believe Great Britain just issued an advisory against traveling to the U.S. because of our shootings, which, like, it's a scary time to be in America. At the same time, I go outside and don't ever think about it, and that's how it is in Israel, too. Like,
okay, so that's
when
a good
I was moving
draw.
To Israel, my friends were saying, like, you know, I had friends and family say, like, oh, aren't you worried? And I had been enough, like, when I moved there, I had been there enough to know that, no, I was not worried in the slightest. You know, I rode buses, I didn't think twice about it. Because, you know, there's a big... culture of hitchhiking in Israel. It's called trekking. I was telling you this last night. You don't put your thumb up. You put your two fingers or your one finger down, like your first finger down. It's called trekking. It's just the word for it. And there's a big culture of that. Like, people hitchhike for sure. And, you know, yes, people have been killed doing that. I mean, there was a big story, obviously, about that. Soldiers have been picked up and killed, and those kids were picked up. But that's happened in America, too, but people still do it. It's still a part of everyday life. I don't know anybody. I've never met an Israeli who didn't do something because of fear of terrorism or attacks. Like, just like America. I don't know any Americans who are afraid to go to movie theaters now, despite the tragedy of, like, two shootings in a movie theater in the last, you know, however many months.
Yeah, sure.
I've never had an American tell me, oh, I'm not going to go to the movies anymore. Like, I'm afraid of that. Which, it's tragic, and, I mean, God forbid it ever happens again.
Yeah, I mean, we shouldn't, like, downplay it or anything, or, like,
no,
brush it aside. You know, keep it in mind, but that's just what's going to get reported in the news.
Exactly.
And it's one of these things that kind of drives me mad, even though I fully understand why the news companies, this is what they have to report. They're not going to report, like, nothing happening.
They report what sells.
Yeah, this is what sells. And that's just how it goes.
Yeah.
But it does create a culture of fear, I think.
For sure.
And
you see it in our politics, and you see it in our, you know, I mean, certainly watching the news, it's like a scary time to watch the news in America. Let's say that.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't think it's a scary time to be in America. I think it's a scary time to watch the news in America.
Sure, yeah. Oh, just turn that off. It's just not good for you.
Yeah, I let The Daily Show me the clips, and then I read everything online.
Yeah, there you go.
I read most of my news. It's a lot harder to use sensationalism when you're reading an AP-style story about what happened than it is when you're watching the news and there's scary music and crazy fonts.
All that,
You know, like, it's just not a necessary component of, like, understanding the world around me is, like, letting a news network try to scare me into not going outside.
Yeah, yeah. The one exception where, like, you're on the internet and it's actually worse than watching TV is when a video comes up. And, I mean, some of these websites put up, like,
that's
really
true.
Graphic shit. Like, I should not be watching this. I don't want to see
I'm
this.
Pretty good about... I mean, I get my news from Twitter a lot, meaning that I can wind up... You never know where you're going to wind up, but I get a lot of my news from, like... I try to read news from sources that I believe in and, like, trust.
Mm.
So, you know, like, I know Vox is not going to show me something horrific without giving me a, you know, a warning. So it's going to be a VOX, Vox.
Yeah.
you know, like Vox is like a great one where it's like, you can kind of trust that they're going to be mature about how they show you the news. And if there's something horrific to see, like they'll let you know it's horrific and then you can decide whether or not to watch it. Yeah. As opposed to you clicking on an article and suddenly a pop-up of six people shooting, you know, some guy who's already on the street.
Right, like, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
I'm going to live with that today, you know?
Yeah, then that's stuck in your brain.
We should see it. I wish it didn't happen.
Yeah.
But it's, yeah, I haven't even had coffee today, you know, let me settle in for a second. It's like a terrible thing to start. It's a terrible thing to have happened.
It is.
Anything beyond that, not much left to say.
I mean, I don't know, like, I've traveled a lot in Latin America, of course. And
sure.
Basically all those countries.
You wrote a book about it, right?
yeah, it's called 1,000 Days Between.
I've heard of it.
Look for it on Amazon today.
Yeah, for sure. Or the website, 1000daysbetween.com.
Yeah, that's right. Anyway, yeah, I've traveled a lot, and if like someone gets into a car accident and dies, pretty much in any of those countries, that's going on the newspaper, and like the dead guy is on the front page.
Nationally or locally?
Locally, maybe even some countries, maybe nationally. But you know, walking down the street, you'll just see like the newspaper stands and blah blah blah. What's in the front page of the newspaper? Ah, like dead guy on the street died in the car accident, wow. Or got stabbed to death, pool of blood around him,
right.
And he's sprawled out on the ground. And it's just more acceptable there. And they'll even say, like, they'll even be, like, inside, here's the people who died today, and pictures of all of them. And it's, like,
you stuff found that pretty across the board in Latin America? Like, that was just...
I can't even remember a specific country, but it just seemed like... I might have this a little bit off, but it seemed like every country I went to had that kind of thing. And it's just something that was always in the background wherever I traveled. And it was just hard for me to get over that, how that's just totally acceptable there. And that just wouldn't fly here.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I started traveling. So, okay, I had traveled a little bit as a kid. Not a lot. I traveled a lot domestically, and I'd like gone on family vacations and things. But I'm sure you have your own way of thinking about it, but there's definitely a difference between travel and adventure, if you will, really like exploration of a place. So I'd done a lot of like the kind of travel, like let's spend a night in this country or a few hours as a kid, but I'd never really like gone off and like explored a place until I was a little bit older. And when I did, you know, I mean, I think the most important reason to travel almost... Certainly one of the most important reasons to travel is that it helps you understand that the world you live in is not the only world that exists.
Immediate surroundings.
Yeah, like I live in a world that I understand pretty well, not completely, but like pretty well. And then I go to another country and realize that many of the things that I just assume are part of life are not part of life, they're part of my life. And that doesn't make them good or bad, it's just helpful to see like how things are different. I often say like, the next best thing to traveling is spending time with people who are traveling.
Yeah,
because
sure.
When you're at home and you have a friend who's traveling, so I used to actually have quite a few Israeli friends in San Diego when I lived there, and I loved it because he would point things out to me about my own culture, my own society, my own world that I'd never thought about because I saw it through my own prism, which was, this is normal. And I was 23 years old, you know, like I was still like learning to understand how to process the world. And he would say, you know, like one thing he pointed out to me, silly, stupid thing that I think about still a lot. In Hebrew, there's essentially one word for big. There's a few other little ones, like there's a word like for giant.
There's little big ones.
Yeah, right? but like for the most part, you say gadol. Gadol means big. In English, we have like, we could sit here and list for the next 10 minutes.
Sure.
Huge, gigantic, enormous, you know, and it says a lot about like how we process the world. Like we have so many words for big. Does that make it good or bad? Neither. You know, it's just like interesting. Like I can exclaim that truck is huge or ginormous. Like that's a nice slang one.
Yeah, we even came up with new ones.
Right. Whereas he would just say, that truck is big. Like that's the extent of his vocabulary for that. And there are a few other words for it, but like we have like a litany of words to mean big. I'm like, that's a pretty interesting American, or it's not American, obviously it's English, but an English thing. And like, I don't really know the roots of it, but it's a pretty interesting concept when you think about like where we put that. But also just like generally, you know, in Israel, they have a green light, a yellow light, a red light. And before it goes back to green, the yellow light comes on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've seen that in a few countries.
Right. Like, you know, when I first saw that, I was like, oh, that's so weird. And now it's like, oh, that's cool. You know, like, makes sense. Right. And, like, whether or not we should do it as well is irrelevant. It's more just, like, understanding that, like, green, yellow, red is not right. It's just what we do. And realizing that that's not necessarily, like,
it's just
has to be what it is a great way to get perspective on the world.
Right? Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of that, I remember reading that Chairman Mao for a while was contemplating switching the lights in China
to
red would mean go. Yeah, red was a go color, not a stop color.
he decided against it.
Yeah, luckily. That would be so confusing.
Super confusing.
That for anyone visiting. God, can you imagine that? Like, it's one thing to drive on the left.
I saw a guy get hit by a bus in New York, and I'm confident he was Irish. We spoke to him after, and he got hit. I mean,
he was okay.
Or? Well, he had to go to the hospital. He didn't want to. He was like a big tough guy.
That's like what we say. Like,
was trying to catch a plane.
If I get hit by a bus someday,
right? You know, like, we were both on our way to the airport. Like, we were taking a shuttle to the airport to like JFK or whatever in New York, and I saw him get hit by the bus. And essentially a cop showed up. He wanted to just go. And my mom's a nurse. She was there. And she said, most likely he's in shock. He's like, it hurts, but I'll deal with it. But in 3 hours when he was over the Atlantic and realized that he had like some broken his arm and like had some serious problems.
Yeah.
So they would not let him go to the airport. They made him go to the hospital. He did not want to go. But I am sure he got hit by a bus because he looked the wrong direction crossing the street, which I've almost done as well in countries that drive on the other side of the street. You know?
Yeah, like, me too.
It's really hard. It was really hard for me when I was in England to. It's just so integral to like
you cross the street left.
It's instinctual. Yeah. You don't think about it. You just look.
I learned to just look both ways no matter what.
Smart.
And I actually even in China I do, even though they drive on the right because a lot of people drive on the left.
Like they do whatever.
They go
Latin America. Are most countries on the right, or it's pretty split.
No, almost every country is on the right. Let's see.
That's right.
Guyana is on the left. Ooh, in South. They're not really Latin America, but it's part of South America.
Sure.
And that's an old English colony, so that's why. I'm pretty sure Suriname was still on the left.
But
and
most of
Belize.
Right.
But, yeah, almost.
Belize? I was in Belize. I don't remember.
Oh, maybe anymore. Belize wasn't?
I don't remember it being, but don't quote me.
It's a small country.
For sure. Super small country.
Someone from Belize will, like, chime in.
DJ Callers.
I'm from Belize, dude. We drive with lips. You insensitive club.
You have a hashtag people can write to talk to us about our
For comments. Angry comments. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Well, actually, put it
address it to Brian Williams at NBC News.
Just
the Daily Show always used to do that, Jon Stewart. He would always say, if you didn't like this segment, please write to Brian Williams at NBC Nightly News.
Well, in all seriousness, there is a comment section below the download part for the blog, so you can always comment if you want.
Want
to tell me where Belize, which side of the road they drive on.
If anybody knows, we can also look it up.
There's no way I can ever find that out. I can't think of any resource.
Yeah, Wikipedia is not going to do it.
Nah. But yeah, and the other thing I was going to bring up, I was just in Hong Kong.
Okay.
Not long ago, like
five days ago.
Right. Yeah, it feels like a long time ago.
Yeah.
But that obviously is also an English, old English colony.
Sure.
And so they still drive on the left. And a lot of the streets, they've done something really simple and nice. On a lot of the streets.
Oh, cool.
They've done something really simple and nice. They've painted in bright white letters on the road, look left or look right.
Oh,
whichever way you're supposed to look.
Just at the crosswalks or like intermittently throughout the country or what?
No, just on the crosswalks. Not every road has them, but a lot, like over half. And I'm sure that's why, right?
Because
people have gotten hit by cars.
So I'll tell you, you've never been to Egypt, have you?
No.
So the main road that kind of cuts Cairo in half, I can't remember what it's called, but it's like essentially a highway. And it pretty much cuts the country in half. You have to cross it. Like, if you're exploring Cairo, you're going to cross this road several times. It's a big road. And there are lights essentially saying when you can cross, but they do not match up with anything on the street. So essentially they tell walkers they can go, but they don't tell drivers to stop.
What?
And it's literally the closest I've ever come to dying. I almost got hit by a truck crossing the street in Cairo. And it was not because I thought like, oh, I could just do it. It was there. It's like playing Frogger. Like
it is
a scary thing to do. Actually, a friend of mine was telling me his grandma was there and she actually would hire cabs to just drive her across the street.
Just across
it's like
the road.
That kind of like intensity. Wow. And I've heard from people in Cairo who said, oh, this is nothing. You should see. And they named, I don't remember where, but like they were like, this is easy, you know? So like I know
it always turns into that when you talk about traffic.
Right.
Ah, that's nothing.
But there's just no way to cross the street. You have to just like run across traffic. It was one of the scariest moments of my life.
Oh,
was trying
my
to
God.
Cross the streets in Cairo. It was pretty funny.
Yeah.
But totally worth it. Cairo was amazing. I was there before the Arab Spring. I can't speak for what it's like there today. I'm sure it's still great. But when I was there, we loved it. I went with two friends. We spent a few weeks traveling up and down.
On the Nile?
I spent a few nights on the Nile, like on a felucca.
Yeah.
So I've been to Egypt three times, twice just to the Sinai Peninsula. We took trips just like from Israel. We spent a few nights kind of like, you know, in like a little bungalow type thing on the water on the Red Sea. But I did one trip where we started in Cairo. We went up to Alexandria, and then we took a train down to Aswan, which is the southernmost city. And then from there, you can take a trip. It's about an hour south, and you're actually right on the border with Sudan. It's Abu Simbel, which is this ancient city. City's not the right word. It's an ancient. I don't know. It's unbelievable. I mean, the statues. It's like essentially giant statues built into caves and mountains. And then it turned out that in the 70s, when they were creating Lake Nasser, they essentially flooded the region. And they had actually moved the mountain up the hill because it was going to be flooded. So it's like both amazing from like an ancient perspective and also from a modern architectural perspective. It's unbelievable. Yeah. In the 70s, they literally picked up a piece of a mountain with 30 and 40 foot tall statues and like all these amazing pieces. They picked up the mountain and moved it up the hill.
With enough will, you can move mountains.
And they will, yeah. They played the Soviets against the Americans and got one of us to pay for it. It was a nice play.
Ah, that's a good one.
For the Egyptians, yeah. The Soviets paid for it, I believe, through the UN, but it was like a Soviet project. Pretty amazing. So then we spent two nights on a felucca, which is literally a little... It's like... I say literally. It's like a plank and a little sail. It was awesome.
Two nights on it. Sleeping on it.
Yep,
on a plank.
We spent about... yeah, we spent like 40, 50 hours on a boat traveling up the Nile, and then we worked our way to Luxor. So we were there in the off-season. It was very hot. It was summer. Usually they put eight people on a felucca. They're covered. So it's like just like a flat bed and then a covered spot. You can't really you can't stand up in it. But it was like normally they would put eight people on it. I don't know what the normal cost is, but because it was the off-season, it was $20. Something like that, covered three meals a day, which they were making right out of the Nile. I mean, they were literally like washing, you know, they say don't like even look at the water in the Nile, you'll die, which is true in Egypt, but because it's so far south, the water's coming underneath the Aswan Dam, and it's actually clean water. So we were like...
I don't know, Josh. I think if you think you can drink that water, you're clearly in denial.
Oh, nice. So yeah, we spent two nights on this. Oh, there was just four of us. It was like awesome. And then we took that and we went up to Luxor, which is where like Valley of the Kings are. And we traveled around Luxor for a few days, and then back to Cairo, and get to see the pyramids and all that good stuff.
Sounds awesome.
It was amazing.
Do you know if it's like possible still to come, to go all the way to Lake Victoria? Or is that just way too, like, politically dangerous or...
I don't know.
Just crazy.
I don't know.
I was just, like, reading a few months ago. I read this book about Henry Morton Stanley and Dr. David Livingstone. And that's a really famous story from about 150 years ago. Yeah, searching for the source of the Nile. And
I mean, that's... You're talking about going all the way down into Ethiopia, then?
Yeah.
Right.
That'd be interesting. Africa's the only country I haven't been to yet. So.
Continent.
Oh, I said it's country. Continent. I've been. Yeah, there's plenty of countries I haven't been to.
For the record, Josh knew that Africa was a continent. The Nile is one of the few countries in the few rivers. it's one of the few rivers in the world that is. Actually controlled by the upstream society that accesses it. So Egypt actually has more control of the Nile than Ethiopia, even though it starts in Ethiopia. It's a pretty interesting, like, geopolitical, post-colonial situation.
Yeah, there's a few of those in the world.
Yeah, but not a lot. There's not a lot of countries that control rivers that start in other countries. Like, Ethiopia cannot further dam the Nile, even though they could literally just put up a dam and stop the Nile from flowing through Egypt. It's pretty crazy. Like, Egypt gets the water last, but actually has the most control over it. I'm not sure there's any place else like that. Leave it in the comments.
Yeah, usually it's the other way around.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, wherever the river starts, like, that's who controls it, and then their beneficence or otherwise, you know, determines how much moves on, but Egypt actually controls it much more than Ethiopia, which has to do with, like, colonial times. There was a treaty, and it's a pretty interesting situation. Yeah, but you spent way more time on a way bigger river.
Oh, well, yeah, not longer, but
I was only on that river. I was only on the Nile for two months.
No, I mean the river itself.
You spent longer.
Okay, the time was longer than yours, but
and the river
I'm referring to, that we're referring to, is the Amazon, of course, and that river has a lot more water than the Nile.
It's not longer than the Nile, you're saying.
Right, yeah. Most experts now agree that the Nile is a little bit longer. Not a whole lot longer, maybe 100 miles or something.
Sure.
But there's not, like, necessarily a clear-cut answer as to where the source of a river is, because it can branch in so many ways.
Mm-hmm. And come together from so many places.
Yeah. The generally accepted rule now is that the Nile is the longest river, and Amazon's second, but...
But as far as water, like...
There's no contest. Close, right. Yeah, the Amazon has so much more water. You can barely see the other shore when you're near the shore.
That's great.
It's like an ocean.
Yeah.
And... Yeah, I mean, I went to Manaus, and that's, if you watch the World Cup, there was at least one game in Manaus, in the middle of the jungle, basically. Well, it's a big city, it's over a million people, but it's in the Amazon rainforest, and the giant ocean liners actually can go all the way up to that city. It's like 1,000 miles inland.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and even Iquitos, the almost that big of ships can go all the way to Iquitos, which is in Peru.
Wow.
It's crazy big.
Yeah, that's crazy.
There's so much water there.
So much water.
But actually the Amazon actually used to flow the other direction.
When did
that change? Much as the, like 100 million years ago.
Sure.
Not that long ago.
Was that before or after they built the pyramids?
Yeah, no, just a couple years before then.
Right.
Right when we started keeping records. Yeah.
What switched it? Was it like a...
The Andes. Andes came up and
yeah, they emerged and just
yeah,
that's crazy.
Yeah, it's nuts. Like the Andes Mountains are all the way on the west side of South America, and this water starts way up in those mountains and flows all the way across the continent.
That's insane.
It is. It's definitely actually, if you want to, like, go, if you're really interested in viewing wildlife, it's like the actual Amazon, probably not your best place, because, like, that's their highway. I mean, there's like. Manaus is the one exception that has roads going to it, but most of the villages along the river, they don't have any roads.
Ooh.
Roads within the village, but not connecting each other. So the only way to get places is just to take a boat. And so these ships will come, like, a lot of these villages, ships come once a week, like in some of the tributaries, and drop off all their supplies for the week. It's really cool. I mean, I rode one of these up the Paraguay River. I don't think that's connected to the Amazon
system. What,
you ride up the
river?
A bigger boat, but it's one of these ships that it goes like once a week. And that's I don't think that's part of the Amazon waterway. I'm trying to visualize it, but it still is like one of these smaller rivers.
I don't know if it'll help. It's not a great map.
Yeah.
It's a fun map.
But anyway, it's. That was fun. They just packed these boats full of motorcycles and chairs and
like anything. A ferry. It wasn't like the dugout that you did.
No, not like a little canoe. This has a lot of people on. You bring a hammock, you sleep on board. But same with the Amazon. Yeah, I just got on in Iquitos, which is in Peru, and it's like 500,000 people, and it's one of these cities with no roads leading to it.
Wow.
So the only way to get to Iquitos, you can take a boat there or fly there. Well, you can't survive there.
That's crazy.
500,000 people.
It's surrounded by swamp or water or jungle?
It's where two of the big, I don't know what they call it, tributaries? Yeah, I guess tributaries of the Amazon come together to actually form the Amazon.
Okay.
And it's right at the confluence of those two rivers.
Okay.
And it's, again, I don't know, a couple thousand miles inland.
Wow.
And yeah, I got on one of those boats, rode down to the border with Colombia. Colombia has a little patch of land that touches the Amazon.
Oh, that's it? Just a drop?
Yeah, well, on the map of the continent, it looks small. I mean, it's probably 50 miles wide.
Sure. But
yeah, it's just a little bit. And then there's across the river, you have, or actually across the street, you have Brazil.
Hmm.
And it's hard to even tell that there's a border between two countries there. Just the signs change, languages. And,
sure.
Yeah, they're very, you can walk across very easily. But then, yeah, then from there, 4 more days down to Manaus. So that was like 7 days on the actual Amazon River. And then.
This is a different trip. This is not the dugout trip. This is the trip that you started in bigger ship.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is one of those. Yeah, gotcha. I'm kind of splicing a few trips together.
Cool.
Well, I probably spent, I don't know exactly how many months, maybe 4 to 6 months in the Amazon, maybe more than that, even 8 months in the region, in that watershed,
sure.
And but actually on the river just like 1 week.
Huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, makes sense.
Yeah, and but then I took the road north out of Manaus at that point, so I didn't actually get all the way down to the mouth until later, but came from a different direction.
Okay.
And then flew over this island that's bigger than Switzerland.
Bigger than Switzerland?
Yeah, Ile de Marajó.
Wow.
And it's
inhabited? I mean, there's people there?
There's like scientific projects going on there. I don't think there's any villages or towns on
there's
it.
Nothing there's nobody
it's
indigenous.
Just jungle. I don't think there are any indigenous people. I might be wrong on that too.
Sure.
This entire podcast is just complete bullshit. It's just. With no fact checking.
you can go back and correct the record.
Yeah, I'll correct it. I'll throw some links.
Go Google in some stuff.
Yeah, I'll Google.
Is that how these podcasts usually go?
Yeah, pretty much.
Cool. That's,
you just say whatever you think.
They're not expecting like Pulitzer Prize winning commentary on the world.
Well, everything that you read on the internet is true. I mean,
Abe Lincoln
said that.
Right. Exactly. He said that about the internet?
Yeah.
He was a big fan of Google search, for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
My experience.
For sure. Anyway, yeah, this island is, it's bigger than Switzerland. It's all in the river.
That's crazy. It's just surrounded by the river.
Yeah, the river divides and goes around it.
That's crazy.
And then the water goes out into the ocean, and you can be on a ship 100 miles out to sea and dip your cup in the water and then drink it, because it's still fresh water.
Wow.
Well, you might get jarred.
Yeah, you shouldn't drink it.
Yeah, maybe not drink it.
You should not drink the water if you're listening. No, but it's not salt water.
I'm not in denial.
Right.
You are into Amazon.
Right. That's crazy. 100 miles into the ocean, and it's still fresh water?
Far out.
Give or take.
Far out.
To be fact checked soon.
Yeah, very far out in the ocean.
That's cool.
And it's still fresh water. It's amazing.
There's a pretty amazing aquarium in the southernmost city of Israel. It's called Eilat. It's built on the Red Sea. It's Israel's it's the only part of Israel that's on the Red Sea. It's most of Israel, like the entire western part of the country, is on the Mediterranean. And then they have the Dead Sea, and they have the Galilee up in the north, the Kinneret, which is like a waterway. It's where Jesus walked on water, where he's supposed to have walked on water. But then in the very south, there's the Red Sea. And you can go to this aquarium. It's an amazing aquarium. There's this walkway. And if you walk down a flight of stairs, they actually built a 360-degree looking tower or whatever into the coral reef. So you can actually walk and be completely surrounded on all sides by coral reef and all like the life of the water. It's the Red Sea, that part of the world is the northernmost coral reef on the planet. Wow. So like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Israel, like they all kind of have like access to it. But then if you go up the tower, so instead of being at ground level, if you go up one more floor, like, and all it is a lookout tower, you can actually see Egypt, Jordan, Israel, and Saudi Arabia all at the same time.
Whoa.
There's things like that in the north, too, where you could be in a spot and, like, look over the hills and see all the way to Jordan. Or you could be in a spot and see, like, Syria, Lebanon, and Israel all at the same time. But this aquarium, and it's literally, I mean, you're going up one flight of stairs. It's not like, you're not, like, climbing the world's greatest tower.
It's not the
Tower
of Babel.
Yeah, you're just going up, like, you know, a couple stories.
Yeah.
And you're, you can see Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Israel, and Egypt all together. Pretty amazing.
God, that's cool.
So when we were in Dubai, not Dubai, sorry, my cousin lives in Dubai. When I was in the Sinai Peninsula, we were staying on a beach, and there was kite surfers on the water. Not kite surfers, they were wind surfers.
Okay, yeah.
And they were far enough away that it was hard to tell where they had started, and on the other side of the water was Saudi Arabia. Like, it's that kind of proximity to the Saudi Arabian coast across the Red Sea.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Definitely. And
yeah.
What about the Dead Sea? I've heard that's getting, like, even more dead or more...
Deadinger?
Yeah.
However you that's put it. True. It's
that's
shrinking.
True? Oh, it's shrinking.
Well,
it's
what's
like
happening...
drying up, or...?
It's drying up, yeah. Mostly because less water is getting into it from the north, because that water is being used for agriculture and sustenance. And so... Uh-huh. I heard a tour guide once say a really beautiful metaphor. He showed us a map. So if you look at Israel, you've got the west coast is all along the Mediterranean, the whole thing. And then you've got the, essentially along the east part of Israel, like, essentially, when people talk about the region, they'll often say between the Mediterranean and the Jordan, because the question is like, a future Palestinian state is in there as well, or is occupied territories, or Judea and Samaria, whatever you're going to call it. But essentially, you're looking at, like, two peoples, but all of those peoples, essentially the border for those future two states is between the Jordan River, which cuts the entire east part of the country, and if you cross that, you're in Jordan. And then the west part of the country is the Med. So connecting the... from the northernmost part of the Jordan River is the Kinneret, the Sea of Galilee.
Okay.
That's like the northern waterway. And then as you go south down the Jordan, you end in the Dead Sea. And so this tour guide, what he said, he was talking about that the Kinneret accepts water from the tributaries to the north and gives water to the Jordan. So it's like this, it's this living thing, and there's like all this life there. The Dead Sea only accepts water. It doesn't return anything. So it's like a nice metaphor that, like, if all you do is take, like, it will kill you.
Okay.
In Israel, they don't call it the Dead Sea. They call it the Salt Sea.
Salt Sea.
Yeah, okay. Yam HaMelech. But people know Dead Sea. But the Dead Sea is dying because it's not getting enough water to keep it replenished. And it's a real big problem. I've actually read stories. I've never been to one, but there are, like, seaside resorts there. I've been to some seaside resorts there, but I've never been to one of these. Back in the 70s, they were building seaside resorts where you could walk out of your room and essentially be on the beach, right at the water, and now you have to take a shuttle to get to the water. Like, it's that kind of a difference.
Whoa, it's not just like 20 feet or something. It's
like a foot a year or something like that. I'm not sure exactly the distance, but it is significant. And there is a point where it will stop shrinking because the salt water will stop allowing the water to evaporate, but it will not be... what it is today. Like, right now, it's one of the, like, the most mineral-rich places in the world, and that's why you see, like, in any mall in America, you'll see these kiosks that are selling, like, Dead Sea mud products and Dead Sea minerals, because it's this really healthy minerals that from the Dead Sea, but they're essentially, like, it's being depleted, and it's a real problem for the Dead Sea. And so, it's controversial, because some people say, like, we need to let water keep coming, and other people say, right, but we're using that water to grow food and to drink water. There's been several projects. So there's this thing called the... First, they were going to do the... I don't know which came first, but there's a really amazing school in... it's actually on a kibbutz called Keturah. It's called the Arava Institute, and it's a pretty amazing place. It's pretty international. Jews, Arabs, I met Iranians there. There are people from all, and Americans as well, and Canadians, but it's like a really amazing, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, it's a science
was it
resource.
Seminar?
No, it's like a place, like people study there. It's not a university, but it's a place like they hold seminars and, exactly sure. It's an institute, so like they'll go there and do programs. But they have this plan, and it's it's been talked about forever, and who knows what will happen, but it's called the Red to Dead, where they're actually going to build a waterway between the Red Sea and the Dead Sea to continue filling it with water. And they've also talked about the Med to Dead, so doing the same from the Mediterranean to the Dead Sea, trying to connect them in a way that they can, like, essentially push water back into the Dead Sea. It's problematic. It's got its issues. It's also very expensive. It's also very complicated because, especially with the Red Sea, anything they do would be between Israel and Jordan, so it has to be in complete... You know, one side couldn't do it without the other, which is a good thing because it's a great project that they have, like, been working on together. But as of at this point, it's not happening. Like, whether it happens in the future or not, hopefully it will, but I don't know the state of it at the moment.
Huh. That sounds like something that could take a long time, even if they decide, like, after they decide to do it, too.
Huge, huge project. Yeah. And the word I was looking for was ecological. Like, they do ecological work at the Arava Institute. Okay. It's, you know, it's like, it's a pretty cool spot. You know, talking about desalinization and, you know, things like that.
Yeah,
Israel has some of the best desalinization processes in the world.
Okay. And are they getting that from the Mediterranean, mainly?
Mainly.
Yeah.
Maybe exclusively, but I'm not sure.
There's not much fresh water in Israel?
There's some. There's not enough. I mean, it's a lot of people.
Man, water's a big problem in
a lot of the world. Sure, the whole region obviously is a big problem. So desalinization is definitely, like, one, like, avenue that they're exploring.
Yeah, yeah.
I've been to kibbutzim that showers and dishwashers and stuff work with salt water. Like, they don't use fresh water to take showers in, because it's not like salt like in the ocean, but it's more salt than...
like brackish,
kind of. Yeah, and like that's what they use to like shower, because they're trying to conserve.
Yeah, but that's how it was in the
But if you go to Tel Aviv or Jerusalem, you'd never know that there was... You know,
just
like here.
It just feels normal.
I mean, just like on a Phoenix, you'd never know that there was an issue, even though they have terrible water shortage problems in California. I mean,
wow.
You know, I'm sure my friends in San Diego still take showers every day and don't think twice about it, even though they have, you know, definite water shortage issues. So it's like that. There's water shortages, but not enough that people feel it.
Yeah, it's strange to talk about like that, though, that there's shortages, but people still use the water.
Sure.
I remember being in Cusco, and like every afternoon after a certain time, the water just shut off.
Really?
At least in the part of the city I was staying in, which is up the hill a little bit.
So it's harder to get to it? Like, harder to get the water there?
Yeah, and I was staying in a little hostel, like, surrounded by houses in a residential area, not in a nice hotel or anything. So I think the fancy hotels, it was fine always, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, and so the people, it's just...
I just live with it?
I don't know. Yeah, they would, like, take big buckets and just fill them in the morning with water.
Sure.
And that's their water for the day, because they know it's getting cut off.
Yeah.
But then that kind
of
makes
I mean, there's plenty of places in the world that you don't have the couple hours a day of running water to fill the bucket. You got to walk down to the well.
Oh, yeah, you don't even have that. Yeah, you have to walk a long ways.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
For sure. It's easy to forget that when you're living in a comfortable society.
Which goes back to what I was saying earlier, like, just realizing that your world is not the world, you know? Israel is a first world country. It is a very their high tech is amazing, but when you wake up in the morning, the first thing you have to do is switch on your hot water heater, which is on the roof, if you want to take a hot shower in the morning. Like, you know, I don't know any American that would, like, that's just not a thing, you know? Like, for us, our hot water is hot when we want it to be hot. Maybe it takes 20 seconds to heat up, you know, when you turn on the shower, but in Israel, they put them on the roof, they're heated by the sun, and it's technologically very smart what they're doing. Like, it's, you know,
sure.
But, you know, you flip a switch, just like you're turning on a light. When you want to take a shower, you give it a few minutes, you know, like 20 minutes before you can take a shower. If you want hot water.
It takes that long.
Yeah, it's not immediate. It, like, takes time to heat up.
Yeah, and, like, I was a little taken aback coming back here after traveling in South America for so long. Because they're, well, I shouldn't generalize the whole continent, but in a great deal of the continent, you have electric showers. It's pretty standard. Instead of having a tank, there's just a heating element directly on the faucet.
Oh,
and, excuse me. That sounds like a terrible idea, right? Putting electricity on the shower head. And in fact, quite often it is. And,
people get hurt.
Maybe not, like, severely injured, but I've definitely been shocked. And a lot of the time there's, like, a switch on the wall, and it kind of looks like when they're going to give someone the death penalty in the electric chair, you flip this giant switch up, like,
Does it work pretty well?
But, yeah, I guess that's where I was going with this. The the good ones especially don't shock you, and it heats water on demand. You just turn it on, and boom, you got hot water. And
can you control how hot?
Yeah, you can.
Nice.
And you never run out. You,
yeah.
As long as you have water,
you have hot water.
Yeah,
that's smart.
It's one-to-one. As soon as it flows through that head, it's that good that it can heat it quickly.
You just can't readjust that shower head at all.
Right, you're not, like, afraid to touch it.
Yeah, I would imagine it's very hot as well.
Oh, yeah, the shower head? Yeah, yeah.
Oh, it's literally heating the water.
It is, yeah. And some of them are, like,
it's like the opposite of an ice flute or whatever. What do they call them when you take a shot, like, through a, like, an ice...
like ice bar type thing.
Yeah, type of thing. It's the opposite. Yeah. Just, like, makes it cold. It's fine.
Yeah, yeah. But it's kind of like, it's something that you see in developing countries, but it's actually in some ways superior to our water. Because, like, when you think about it, if you live, well, let's just say you live alone. In America, you take a shower maybe 10 minutes a day, and this water tank is holding, like, 50 gallons of hot water and just keeping it hot.
Keeping it hot, yeah.
24 hours a day.
Yep.
And you're using it for 10 minutes.
Right.
I mean, it's... Well, and for, like, washing your hands.
Sure,
okay, but washing the dishes.
Like, not 6 hours, right?
Right, no. It's, like, the vast majority of the time it's just sitting there and it needs to be continuously heated.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's just so... like, when you think about it, it's just so wasteful in energy.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
And actually, even our place in Beijing, we have a... We don't have an electric shower, but we have a... gas water, and but it's again one, like, I don't know how to say it, like one to one or on demand.
Okay,
there's no tank, is what I'm getting at.
Oh, so. It's like it flows through, gets hot, and comes out.
Yeah, yeah. It takes maybe 20 seconds to get hot, but once it's hot, you can keep it hot however long you need it.
Sure,
you never run out. And there's just a pilot light on the gas tank.
Okay,
so it. You're not like continuously heating this water,
right?
So it's actually pretty nice. That's one thing. Like travel, I think even if you're if you think about entrepreneurship or being creative or inventive, travel can be so great because you can see other countries just how they do things, and it even in some very poor countries they do some things better than we do.
Sure,
in some ways. I mean, it's not like we're the best at everything. It's really, you learn a lot of this, and you kind of, as you travel, you can kind of get away from being stuck in your world, stuck in your head, and you can kind of see the forest for the trees type thing, and you can actually see some of these inefficiencies that exist in any society, and it's pretty easy to point them out in other countries when you're used to one system, and then you learn another system, and once you learn all about that new system, like... It's easy to discuss the pros and cons, but it even works the other way, coming back home.
Right.
And learning about your own country.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, coming back from a long trip, you look at your own country very differently, you know?
Oh,
like
you do.
It's a very weird idea. Like, you miss things, you are excited to see things, but you also just reflect on things differently. I know, like, you know, there have been many things in my life that have kind of, like, opened me up and, like, you know, taught me a lot, but traveling is very high on that list of things that kind of, like, just broadened my perspective enough to, like...
So understand and shrooms, like, huh?
check Google. See what they say. But, you know, it's one of those things that just, like, allows you to, like, it's like, in some ways you're, like, literally leaving your planet to go to, like, another planet, you know? Like, first world, third world, like, you know, I mean, even going to parts of Canada can become, even going to different parts of America can, like, blow your mind to see, like, the people. I've lived in 10 states around America, give or take.
10? Wow.
Give or take. And yeah. I've lived all over the country, and, like, life is so different in all of those places. That being said, there are some things that are the same, which is why, like, getting out of the country has been so, like, really good for me. But, yeah, you know, the differences between San Diego and Georgia are pretty vast. I loved them both, you know, like, I had a great time in Athens, Georgia, I had an amazing time in San Diego, Madison is different than both of them, and Washington, D.C., and, yeah, I've lived all over, and, you know, like, every place you go is so different, there's a culture to it, and, you know, I talk to, especially Europeans, I've talked to a lot, not even Europeans, but, well, yeah, quite a few of my friends who were European in Israel, and we were talking about America, and it's so easy to think of America as monolithic, and I always say, like, you're talking about a place the size and population of Europe. So we have a linguistic similarity that Europe doesn't have. Like, obviously, if you're in Prague or you're France or you're in Italy, you're going to have linguistic issues. But other than the linguistic similarity we have, I mean, the Southeast is as different from the Northwest as England is from Austria. You know, like, yeah. They are just two different parts of the world. We just all live in the same political system, we have the same currency, and we have the same language.
But even the, like, the states even have a large degree of autonomy, and...
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, people from other countries ask me questions a lot, like, is this legal in the U.S.? Can you do this? And, like, well, it depends on what state you're in.
There's 51 ways to answer that, depending on where you are.
Yeah, like, totally.
It might be illegal or illegal federally, and then state by state it's different. And I mean, like, the difference between, again, like, the Northwest and the Southeast, I think, in particular, like, such different... And also the Northeast and the Southwest, and, you know, the Middle States and the Plain States, and, you know, it's just, like, America is not a place. It's a million places, you know? Yeah. It's like... And the world is a billion places, you know, it's an infinite number of places.
Just keep this in mind when you, like, talk about other places, other regions, too. Like,
exactly.
Like, we use these words like, well, most Europeans think this. Like, well, not really. Europe is this whole continent.
Wait, I didn't say most Europeans. I said most Europeans.
No, not the same. I didn't necessarily...
No, but China, too. Like, China's 1.5 billion people to, like, try and... place, you know, like... Even Israel, like, I've met so many Israelis, and there's so many different kinds of Israelis, and it's this tiny country with, like, just a few million people, but such an interesting... Israel has what's called the center of the country, which is essentially Jerusalem to Tel Aviv. That is the center of the country, and the vast majority of Israelis live in that center. And then you've got the periphery, which is 80% of the land and 20% of the people. And it's mostly the Negev Desert and then the north, which, like, goes up into the Golan Heights, but also just, like, you've got a few big cities there, but, like, Tel Aviv is like L.A. I mean, it's just, like, it's cities surrounded by other cities all the way until, like they had a problem a while back. I actually haven't followed the story. They were running out of places to bury their dead. Like, that's how, there was no place else to go. Like, they couldn't spread further because they had already spread further. They, you know, like...
Is cremation bad in Jewish...
Jews, quote-unquote, don't cremate.
It's just not allowed.
I'm not saying no Jewish person will be cremated, but, like, halachically speaking, like, Judaically speaking, you're not supposed to be cremated. You're supposed to be buried the way you were, because there's, like, a whole afterlife component to it that you're supposed to come back.
I thought that was true with Christianity, too, but just culturally...
That's
just
not my experience, but I don't know. No, okay. I think that Christians can be cremated. I'm sure, though, to say Christians, again, is like to say Americans.
Yeah, I know.
So I don't know.
But it's just a curiosity.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, if you're running out of space.
I don't know if Christians cremate or not. But Jews, like, again, you're not supposed to, whatever that means, you know.
Yeah.
Like, Jews do whatever they want. But as a religion, cremation is not part of the religion.
Hmm. Okay.
But, but you've got, like, this periphery... which is what it's called, and it's like the north and south. It's like very small populations on a lot of land, but it's like a huge... I mean, 60% of Israel is desert, you know, like the Negev Desert is a huge part of the country, and that's where I lived for a year, and I loved it, actually. I really fell in love with the desert living in Israel. It's a pretty magical place. I don't know that I wanted to, like, spend the rest of my life in a desert, but I really enjoy it.
Yeah, that kind of thing can be cool for a while.
For sure, I really... Yeah. Again, it was a very... it was a great experience for me, spending close to a year living in, like... So the kibbutz I lived on also, same thing, like... Do you know what a kibbutz is?
Well, you should probably explain it just for people.
So a kibbutz, it's a complicated concept if you're not familiar with it, but the easiest way to describe it is it's a commune without the negative connotations. Like, the kibbutz movement is a huge foundation of what started the state of Israel. Like, it was from the kibbutz... Kibbutzim is the plural of kibbutz. That's why I'm saying that, as opposed to kibbutzes. That's just, kibbutzim is easier to say. The founding fathers of Israel, which we're talking about less than 100 years of history, as opposed to American, which is several hundred, the founding fathers of Israel mostly came from the kibbutz movement. The top levels of the military, the politicians, like, they were kibbutzniks. That's the phrase for it, because it's like a Russian, like, kibbutznik.
Ah.
So essentially they were communes, meaning that it was to each their ability, to each their need. They are literally communistic societies. The beauty of them is that they were by choice. So anybody could leave at any time. You weren't, like, forced to stay, which is where, obviously, communism in the, like, some sense, let's not get into it for your personal safety.
Yeah.
but it's complicated, like, if you can't leave... You have to be accepted, and you can't just show up. It's a closed community, but then they work as a group. And so, like, the story I love to tell, Kibbutz Keturah, which is a kibbutz in the south of Israel that was actually started by American Jews in the 50s. It's an amazing place. They have an algae factory. They actually are making algae in the middle of the desert, and it's pretty amazing. The head of...
Why are they making algae?
It's sold for, like, health food and things. Uh-huh. Some guy invented a technology that allowed them to literally grow algae in the desert, uh-huh. and they sell it now. It goes into, like, health food products and things like that. Hmm. The guy who runs the factory, at least when I was there several years ago, is a PhD. He, well-learned, brilliant guy. He has two kids. The guy who keeps the place clean, the janitor or whatnot, he has six kids, so he makes more money every month. Like, it's not at all about what you do, it's about what you need. The beauty of it is, from my time on it, and again, I lived on one for a little while, and this is something that came up from this algae factory, the guy who invented the algae factory, even though he doesn't make more money, his entire community sees a benefit. So, like, a big part of the problem, you know, people always say with Cuba, like, there's no incentive to make a better way to do something because you will never see the benefits of it. Right. Whereas if you lived on a kibbutz in Israel, like Keturah, if you invent a new way to grow algae in the desert, your daily or monthly salary might not go up, but you're suddenly going to have better food in the dining hall. Your kids are going to have a better college fund. You're going to get more money to go on your next vacation. Because literally, and the kibbutz movement has changed a lot. It's become a lot more capitalistic. But literally, the kibbutz movement, you don't pay for anything. And you like so they pay for you to go on vacation. They pay for the kids to go to college. Like it's literally like a group of people that have come together and said, we are going to pay for you. They are essentially a family. And at the very beginning of the state, I don't think there's any kibbutzim that do this now. The kids aren't even raised directly by the parents. They're raised in like nurseries. And it's literally communal parents because like the parents are off working in the field or in the factory and one person is working with the kids or 10 people. I mean, depends on the size. But so like the kibbutz comes together and like pools their resources, which in this case is like power and strength and intelligence, and they are able to create something that's better for all of them collectively. So it's a very communistic concept. And I lived on a kibbutz called Ste Boker, which means Field of Cowboys. And I spent about a third of my time working in the chicken houses. They have chicken houses. They buy chickens the day they're born, which are adorable. And then they raise them to 5 months and then they sell them about $5 a chicken.
$5 for one chicken? That sounds like a lot.
Yeah, for sure. I wrote this long blog post about it once, but they essentially get delivered, in boxes. Like, they're born, put in boxes, brought to us. Yeah. We dump them up onto food. They're happy for a day, and then they're scared of us for the rest of their lives. 5 months, we raise them, and then at the five-month mark, we sell them for $10 a piece. So, essentially, we make $5 per chicken for 5 months' worth of work to raise them. There are hundreds of thousands of them at the kibbutz. Those chickens are being sold to go lay eggs someplace else. So, if somebody else, like, has chickens that lay eggs, we were raising them to get to that point. But then they also had a tape factory where they actually made giant rolls of masking tape. So I did some factory work there. And then I worked, they had a vineyard and they had a garden and I worked a lot actually. It was called like the field, which essentially I became friendly with the guy whose job it was. And then he would get volunteers, however many he needed that day. And it was his job to make sure the fence was in order and that there was no garbage. And that, you know, if we needed to build a trap because a crow was like eating all the plants, we would build a giant like crow trap, and like it was just kind of like an odds and ends thing. I really enjoyed it. I liked the guy who ran. His name was Mickey, and I would just like go like just essentially. He was the handyman for the whole kibbutz. Like if the tractor was broken, it was his job to fix it. If there was garbage that needed picking up, it was his job to get it picked up. But then I also worked in the dining hall and the laundry and the kitchen, which is different than the dining hall. Pretty much did every job there, I think. For a few months. It was fun.
Cool.
Fun is not the right word. It was interesting.
Or a lot of work, I assume.
You know, one of my friends, Sebastian, who's not Jewish, who spends a lot of time living on the kibbutzim, he's from Austria. He pointed out to me something about the kibbutz that, like, I hadn't thought about. The cool thing about the kibbutz is you work 8 hours a day, minimum. Like, that's your day, and 6 days a week for most of them. Mm. I mean, it's pretty intense. Like, it's a lot of work. But a lot of people do that anyway, you know, like, they have a job and they work 40 or 50 hours a week. The beauty of the kibbutz movement is once you're done working, you don't have any other errands to do. Somebody else did your laundry. Somebody else made your meals. Somebody else dealt with the car. Okay. So yeah. Even though you work really hard, and it was hard work. I mean, some days harder than others, of course, but it was hard work. But when you're done, you're done. Like, you don't have all the chores and the
errands. Yeah, you don't come home and do 4 more hours of work.
And there were some people on the kibbutz that worked outside the kibbutz. Actually, the head of the music department at Hebrew U lived on the kibbutz, and he used to commute to Jerusalem every day. The kibbutz was responsible for keeping the car up. You know, like, they gave him a car every day, and he drove it to work, and his salary never went to him. It went directly to the kibbutz. So they paid all of his expenses, and they gave him a monthly stipend, just like everybody else, and when he wanted to go on vacation, there was money for him to go on vacation. And his salary went directly to the kibbutz. So, like, he was still, like, working for it. And then every Saturday, he was responsible for washing dishes. Like, the head of the music school. And, like, you'd see him. He'd be the guy, like, and it's a big industrial thing. I used to work on it sometimes, too. But that was just, like, his job. Like, Saturdays around the kibbutz, it was his job to man the dishes station. Mm-hmm. You know, the rest of the week, he was going to work. But, you know, when you're done, like, you don't have to think about doing the laundry or going grocery shopping or any of that stuff. It's a different way to think about life, you know? It's like literally communal living. Like, you work very hard at one thing, and somebody else is working very hard at all the other things that normally we would have to do after work. So there's, like, a pretty cool side to it. I don't know if I would want to do it for a lifetime, but I'm glad I did it for a while. I would consider going back for a while.
Yeah, as long as you can come and go as you please.
But you pretty much can as a volunteer.
Yeah, it's interesting to learn.
You know, a few weeks, you can do, like, I think a minimum of a month is what they ask for, but I saw people leave after 12 hours. This one volunteer showed up, and literally, he, like, showed up, and the next morning he was gone. And we were like, what happened? They were like, I don't know, he just left.
It's not for him, huh?
So,
it's funny. Thought he was just going to get a place to crash.
I don't know if he didn't like his room or somebody scared him off, but he just... So when I got there, it was pretty interesting, actually. I got there at the end of spring, and I asked specifically to be at a place with less volunteers because I was trying to learn Hebrew, and I thought volunteers would be speaking English, and I'd rather... It was a miscalculation. That's not really the way that it worked. Everybody speaks English. There were a few people that didn't, but most people spoke English. But so when I got there... There was 2 girls from South Africa, 1 or 2 other Americans, several Europeans. There was, like, a girl from France, a guy from Scotland. And then there was quite a few South Koreans. A lot of South Koreans, they were Seventh-day Adventists. And there was a lot of South Koreans on the kibbutz. Like, throughout my time there was probably 6 or 7 out of, like, 20 of our volunteers were from South Korea. They all came, I think all of them. I won't speak for all South Koreans. They all came as Seventh-day Adventists. There was one Japanese guy who was traveling around the world who was awesome. Didn't speak a damn word of English, but just super cool. I mean, like, almost no English. And then summer came around and suddenly, like, you could see it was a much different group of people that came. So instead of it being travelers, it was, like, college kids on their summer break. And it was a much different, like, idea about what kind of work. Like, most of the people that were there when I showed up were, like, ready to work. And, you know, these were people who were, like, either traveling around the world or just, like, looking to do something interesting. And then suddenly, like, there was kind of this weird infuse. Like, as soon as summer break started, a lot of college kids came who clearly thought it would be, like, a fun, sexy place to spend the summer. Didn't actually expect to have to, like, work hard. And we did work hard. And quite a few of them left quite quickly.
One of them,
he got the record. He literally showed up at night and was gone the next morning. Like, packed his bag and left.
I guess. If it's not going to work, why try?
Yeah, whatever. Good for him. Get out of there quickly. I was there for a few months and then I left. And that was when I left there with a friend that I made there and another friend I made earlier. And we went to Egypt together.
Awesome.
Like, the big Egypt trip that I did, not the 2 small ones.
Okay, well, it sounds like a cool experience for a while. If somebody's interested, where should they get started to look for kibbutzes?
The best way to do it is to go to the Kibbutz Placement Center in Tel Aviv.
You'd recommend just going to Israel first?
You could Google the Kibbutz Placement Center. I was already living in Israel when I decided to do this. I was like, had finished up this thing I was doing. And I wasn't sure what to do next. And I was like, you know, I should just go live on a kibbutz, work, try and speak Hebrew, see what happens. So I asked around. I think I literally went to, like, a hostel and was like, how do I go to a kibbutz? Yeah. You know, because, like, they're all over. There's, like, tons of them around the country.
Okay.
And they sent me to the Kibbutz Placement Center, which is in, like, a pretty central part of Tel Aviv. And I think I gave them like $40, which covered the visa and like healthcare or something for 6 months.
Not bad.
Yeah, healthcare there is much more affordable than here.
Yeah.
They took my passport because they had to get it stamped and essentially said, when can you be there? They gave me a placement. And I said like, oh, I'll be there in 3 days or whatever. And they said, okay, cool. And they let them know. And then it was just my job to show up to the kibbutz in 3 days. And my passport showed up a couple days later with a new visa in it. I'd been doing 3 month traveling visas and this was a 6 month, volunteer visa. And then I could have stayed there for a year if I wanted. I think they will accept anybody who can work. Like you have to, you know.
Yeah. But you don't have to be Jewish, obviously. You mentioned several other people who weren't.
There's only one or two. There are religious kibbutzes, a kibbutzim, that won't take you if you're not Jewish. But most of the kibbutzim are actually very secular. There's not really a lot in the middle as far as like religious or secular, which is true about a lot of Israeli society. It's actually a really interesting schism in Israel that you're either very religious or you're not religious at all. There's not a lot of middle ground. Like in America, we have like Reform Judaism and Conservative Judaism. In Israel, they have Orthodox or secular. That's not true completely of certain sects of Judaism, but for the most part, that's the case. But most of the volunteers when I showed up were not Jewish. There was only one or two other Jews, and then in summer, a lot of Jews showed up with summer break. They like came on a birthday trip or whatever.
Where's the party?
Right, exactly. Yeah. Like, you know, there's like this romantic idea that like kibbutzim are like full of like sex and drugs and stuff. Maybe that was true in the 70s. I can't speak to that. It's not true today. That's not to say that there's not fun things going on, and there are fun things, but it's also, you know, like you're going there and you're working. There was a bar, and it was only open 2 nights a week, but it was fun. And, you know, it's like a hilarious place. The kibbutz I was on is actually a very famous one in Israel because the first prime minister of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, retired there. They kind of say he put his money where his mouth was. He was a big advocate that Israel should make the desert bloom. So he fought really hard to essentially get Jews to move to the desert because, as I said, 80% of the population lives in the middle. He wanted people to live in the desert. And so when he finished his prime ministership, he actually moved to Stable Care. They had to vote on whether or not to accept him because everything is done communally. It was 19 members, and I think, don't quote me, but I think that he passed by a margin of one.
Is that close? Huh?
Yeah, he was a 70-plus-year-old man with his wife. He certainly wasn't going to be able to work at the level that they, you know, every mouth there was a mouth to feed. Also, they needed to create, he was literally at some points taking world leaders, like, you know, when somebody comes to visit the White House, that's where they go. They were going to Stable Care, which was like just fields in a desert, but they built him a private spot, and I actually, it was a great joy. I got to hang out in his private office and play cards. I had some friends who were part of their role on the kibbutz was giving tours of his home and office. And so...
Did you play a game of Yaniv?
I don't know Yaniv.
Oh, that's...
Should I?
Yeah, the...
Sounds Hebrew.
Israelis.
Yeah.
In many places.
Yaniv, I don't know that.
Yeah.
It's a board game?
A card game.
Yeah. I don't know by name. Maybe I played it by a different name. But I did play cards in his office. Like,
that's funny.
It was like an awesome moment in my life. I did it a few times. It was very exciting. But so it's a famous kibbutz. Most Israelis, most people like in Israel know Stable Care because David Ben-Gurion's buried nearby, so it's like kind of a spot people go to. He's essentially the George Washington of Israel, and he only died, you know, in our parents' lifetime. So it's like a very, you know, again, like thinking about context, it's like a, you know, he was a huge figure in Israel, and he was alive not that long ago.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty interesting kind of like dynamic.
Cool.
Yes.
So guess what? We've got an hour and a half in. Time flies, huh?
Yeah, for sure. It was.
Yeah. We had to wrap it up.
Thanks for having me on your podcast.
Yeah, thanks for coming. I should mention to everybody, Josh actually edited my book, 1,000 Days Between, and he did an awesome job. He gave me so much great advice. You can tell from hearing him speak that he's very knowledgeable about much of the world. Great. You do a lot of writing work.
I'm a digital storyteller, so I these days I work with brands, helping them find, hone, and tell their story online, meaning social media, writing, web copy, things like that. If people want to check me out online, they can go to joshclemons.com. I do a lot of blogging, offering free advice on social media, building a movement, and brand management, and much more. You can find me on Facebook and Twitter. I am Reverbal Communications. So if you search for Reverbal Communications, you can get lots of great free advice. And like my Facebook page, check me out on Twitter, and say yes. Hello. I'd love to hear what you think.
Sounds awesome, and I'll put links up to all the stuff right where you download the podcast in the show notes, along with all the corrections I'll have to
do. I was going
to
say, if anybody wants to correct any of our made-up facts, just bear in mind that Dan's on China Standard Time.
Yeah. It's not like 6 in the morning, so right. I'm like, it's starting to wake up a bit.
Yeah. So. But yeah, drop me a line on Facebook or Twitter or through my website. I'd love to hear from you and hear what you think, and whether it's to say you enjoyed it or tell me that I got a factor up, I want to hear it all.
Awesome. Perfect. Well, thanks for coming on, Josh. That's all we got.
Thanks, Dan.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. For more information, you can visit my website, 1000daysbetween.com. That's the number 1000daysbetween.com. From there, you can sign up to get updates from this podcast delivered directly to your inbox. Remember, the Around the World podcast is all about meeting ordinary people who have done extraordinary things. Thanks for listening.